Hello there. Today is Monday, October 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as violence escalates, the U.S. is pulling its remaining troops out of Syria.
It'll be a deliberate withdrawal, and we want to conduct it as safely and quickly as possible.
Presidential candidate Joe Biden now fighting back hard against Trump's disproven allegations against him. Also ahead, a prominent DJ creates a new video inspired by climate activist Greta Thunberg. It's all on today's International Edition. At least 60 civilians have been killed and thousands more have fled Syria in the past 4 days as the Turkish aggression against the Kurds continues after nearly all U.S. forces have pulled out. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told ABC's This Week on Sunday that Turkish leaders are aware the U.S. could impose sanctions on their government.
We have warned the Turks. I spoke to the finance minister on Friday. The State Department has also had conversations. They know what we will do if they don't stop these activities.
Syrian government forces will deploy along the Turkish border to help repel the Turkish military incursion against the Syrian Kurds, Kurdish officials announced on Sunday. The extraordinary deal between the Kurds, Syria, and Russia, Syria's main ally, comes 4 days after the Turkish forces moved against the Kurds in northern Syria after almost all U.S. forces pulled out. The U.S. is considering plans to withdraw the remaining American troops from northern Syria in the coming days in what would be a faster-than-expected timeline amid Turkey's escalating offensive. Defense Secretary Mark Esper on CBS's Face the Nation.
We have American forces likely caught between two opposing advancing armies, and it's a very untenable situation.
Joining us now is former Australian ambassador to the Middle East, Dr. Robert Bowker. He is now professor of international affairs at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us, sir. What is your reaction to these fast-moving events that we're seeing in Syria?
The nature of this crisis is complex. It has arisen essentially because the president has chosen to withdraw the United States from a process which had at least some chance of maintaining a balance between the interests of Turkey on the one hand and the Kurds of Syria, the YPG, on the other, and over a longer period, presenting Turkey with a relatively secure southern border against the threat or potential threat of Kurdish irredentism. Now, the sudden decision of Mr. Trump to withdraw U.S. forces in response to a representation from Erdogan of Turkey was unexpected because there were ongoing efforts by the United States to provide reassurance to Turkey, which were a combination of a military presence and a concerted diplomatic effort to reassure the Turks on that score. When you take away the president's support for those conditions, then the Turkish response was almost automatically to proceed to seize that opportunity to produce a military solution to the problem. An extremely disconcerting, disappointing, and I would regard extremely disappointing performance by President Trump. It has clearly betrayed an ally, but in terms of the US's wider interest, it sends a signal that it is an unpredictable administration so far as one's own security interests are concerned, and that assurances that may be given by Trump or his senior officials may easily be overturned at the expense of the regional parties. But also,
would you say it's likely that the president, right after talking to President Erdogan, must have known was to happen? It wasn't like Erdogan made it a secret what he wanted to do.
I don't think that the president was prepared to listen to the advice of his own senior staff on this question. Whether his account of the advice that would have been available from those sources, of course, is something which outsiders cannot know. But the way in which the decision was made and announced, the fact that there is no consultation with the Kurds beforehand, or indeed with America's partners in northeastern Syria, including the British and the French and others, strongly suggests this is an impetuous, reckless decision on the part of the United States.
We understand now that the Syrian army will be deploying the entire length of the border with Turkey to help repel the Turkish offensive. Apparently, the Kurds sought Bashar al-Assad's help, given that they had really nowhere else to turn, apparently. What does that say, and what could that mean going forward?
I doubt that the Syrian army will deploy or engage with the Turkish-backed militias without air cover. And that cover clearly is not going to be provided by the United States or by the Russians. So I would expect to see a no-fly zone, if it comes about, will emerge only after the United States withdraws, and only if Erdogan defies Putin by rejecting the deal mediated by Russia between Damascus and the Kurds, which has led to this agreement in principle for the Syrian army to deploy. In other words, I think we're going to see a period in which the extent of Erdogan's ambitions on this issue become clearer, and the Russians determine whether those ambitions are acceptable before they provide the Syrian army with the air support that it is going to need to take on the Turks effectively. I think it's important to recognize that both Russia and Syria will be happy to see the YPG Kurds weakened and made compliant with a larger Russian interest and the exercise of Syrian sovereignty, including within the parameters of the relationship with Turkey. Turkey matters more to Putin than Syria, and he wants the United States to leave, and that's a huge symbolic victory for Putin that they are doing so. But he also wants the Assad regime to remain viable and vulnerable to Russian pressure, and he wants Turkey to remain a thorn in the side of Europe and, in effect, a thorn in the side of NATO.
All right, that is former Australia ambassador to the Middle East, Dr. Robert Bowker. He's also now a professor of international studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. Hong Kong officials are now labeling the democracy protests as a public safety threat. Tunisia is, the polls suggest, the conservative professor has won the election. Pakistan's prime minister says they are ready to host Iran-Saudi peace talks. And beekeeping is helping veterans cope with stress and anxiety. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Japan began recovery efforts Sunday after a powerful typhoon hit the central island, killing more than 30 people and briefly paralyzing Tokyo. Typhoon Hagibis left parts of central and eastern Japan inundated with rainwaters and floods from overflowing rivers. Close to a half million homes have lost power. The government has sent thousands of troops and rescue workers to help residents fight the floods and search for missing people. VOA's Latika Hoke reports the death toll could rise as some people are still missing after the storm.
Rescuers scramble to reach people trapped by catastrophic flooding brought by heavy rain that caused rivers to overflow. Serious flooding has entered residential neighborhoods in several parts of central Japan. Waters from the Tamagawa River have flooded a hospital in Setagaya City, east of Tokyo. More than 160 patients had to be evacuated.
The flood poured into the ground floor of the hospital and submerged the service counter, reaching up to the height of people's chests.
The government said the storm left some 425,000 homes without power. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe addressed the nation on Sunday.
Along with police, firefighters, and the Japan Coast Guard, 27,000 self-defense forces personnel are currently undertaking rescue and relief activities. We will continue to work with government agencies to repair the damage to infrastructure and recover water and power supplies and restore transportation services.
Officials say some of the worst damage was caused by the Chikuma River overflowing in central Japan's Nagano Prefecture. The full extent of the damage cannot be assessed until water recedes from flooded areas. After the storm subsided on Sunday, authorities warned residents there was still the risk of rivers overflowing and inflicting more damage. In addition, floods are expected to cause deadly landslides.
The major typhoon has caused extensive damage far and wide in eastern Japan. At one point, the special warning for heavy rain was issued for as many as 13 prefectures. There has also been emergency release from various dams and flooding of various rivers. It turned out to be a record heavy rain.
Landing restrictions at Tokyo's Narita and Haneda airports were lifted on Sunday, but more than 800 flights were canceled. Some of the fast train services also were canceled. Powerful Typhoon Hagibis slammed into Japan's Honshu Island Saturday evening, bringing heavy rain and strong winds. The eye of the storm barreled into a peninsula southwest of Tokyo. The typhoon disrupted a three-day weekend in Japan that includes Sports Day on Monday. Zlatica Hoc, VO News, Washington.
Hunter Biden, the son of former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, on Sunday defended his work in Ukraine and China after calls by President Trump that the two countries investigate his business dealings. The accusations have engulfed Trump in an impeachment inquiry, but the president's allies, like Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin on ABC's This Week, say Trump did nothing wrong.
I absolutely believe that our countries should be working together to get to the bottom of what happened, whether it's Burisma, it's Joe Biden, it's Zolchevsky, it's Hunter Biden, that there shouldn't be an immunity from scrutiny just because Joe Biden is running for president.
Meanwhile, Biden called for the impeachment of President Trump this week following the president's efforts to seek damaging information on Biden and his son. Already a front-runner in the 2020 Democratic field, Biden now finds himself part of the battle between congressional Democrats and Trump, a battle that could lead to the president's removal, as VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from New Hampshire.
I'm not going to let him get away with it.
A feisty message from the Democratic front-runner to President Trump.
He's picked the fight with the wrong guy.
As Joe Biden campaigns with a new urgency to maintain his lead in the key early voting state of New Hampshire, which holds the first in the nation presidential primary.
Donald Trump will do anything to get reelected, including violating the most basic forms of democracy.
House Democrats launched a formal impeachment inquiry following whistleblower allegations Trump withheld aid from Ukraine while pressing for damaging information on Biden and his son.
Come on, man.
Biden dismissing the allegations.
There's no truth in his charges and attacks against me and my son. Zero.
And arguing he is uniquely qualified to beat Trump.
Restoring the soul of America. That's what's at stake in 2020. That's why this election is so important. It's why we're not going to let Donald Trump pick the Democratic nominee for president, period.
An argument that appeared to sway worried New Hampshire Democrats.
Today is the first time that I got very emotional because I think that Vice President Biden, there was no gimmicks. There weren't any wild promises. It was just an honest appraisal as to where we're at and where we need to be and hope. He provided hope.
But the president's supporters say Biden's own past working with foreign leaders should be examined.
He should be ashamed of himself with the shenanigans that he's been involved with over the years to try to point the finger at the president for things that are in the course of his responsibilities, I think, are absolutely ludicrous.
And agree with the president's defense that he was addressing corruption.
President Trump did the right thing. Clean, drain the swamp. Those people, they benefit their personal pockets because of the interest. They're selling out our interests.
Biden's candidacy rests on the argument he can appeal to the broadest range of voters, his appeal for decency convincing a voter with more progressive views.
He makes me think that politics could be clean and healthy, vigorous and engaging, and that people could talk across the spectrum to each other. He's that kind of a guy. So I heard myself saying, I don't know if I'm for him, but I'm hearing myself kind of saying I'm for him.
New Hampshire voters still have 4 months to go until early voting begins, a lifetime in politics. But the impeachment inquiry assures that Biden will still be at the center of the debate over Trump. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
U.S. farmers face another season of uncertainty. How much of their crops can they harvest before the weather turns? What price will they get for them? And where will those crops go once they're harvested? As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, the answers, to a degree, rest on the outcome of issues now in the hands of U.S. lawmakers and trade negotiators.
It is the first day of the harvest for Illinois farmer Jared Kunkel. Benchmark he wasn't sure he'd reach while planting corn and soybeans earlier this year.
Yeah, we had a half a day to do something in the entire month of May to plant.
Parts of the Midwest United States experienced soaking and continuous rain during prime planting season, forcing many farmers to put seeds in the ground late, or in some instances, not at all.
This thing is an off-the-chart year.
Wendell Shaman is usually surrounded by brown and dry fields at harvest time. Today, most are green and wet.
This is the second field I planted, but I got done with this one and I didn't plant again for a month.
Now, many farmers like Shaman and Kunkel are in a race against time to get crops out before the frost and freeze arrives.
It's been one of those years. Nothing in 2019 has been easy.
Well, I think the word I would use is challenging.
Mark Gebhardts with the Illinois Farm Bureau says trade uncertainty is compounding farmers' anxiety.
The impeachment proceedings unfortunately come at, again, the worst time for us in terms of trying to get the USMCA ratified, which is a must.
The fate of the United States-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, or USMCA, is with the U.S. Congress. It guarantees access to key markets for U.S. grain products and helps stabilize prices. But many farmers worry the impeachment inquiry in Congress will sideline ratification of the agreement.
The deal's done. You've got three countries that made a deal. I don't understand what they're doing now.
The outcome of negotiations with China, currently locked in a trade war with the U.S., also looms over farmers.
I support going against China. They've been a bad actor against us for years. Were tariffs the right way to do it? I don't know.
But this season of uncertainty is transitioning into a harvest of hope. Japan and the United States recently signed a bilateral trade agreement. The Trump administration also announced new proposals to ensure corn-based ethanol is included in the nation's fuel supply. And prices for corn and soybeans are stabilizing.
So I think there will be opportunities to be able to be profitable this year. But at the same time, we've tried to eliminate some expenses and kind of make sure the equipment we're using is what we need, not necessarily what we want.
What Kunkel says he also needs but doesn't want is a payout from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's $16 billion market facilitation program, which aims to offset price declines from tariffs on crops. Kunkel, like most farmers, prefers trade over aid. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Coleman, Illinois.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Human trafficking has become a worldwide epidemic that's impacting women and children and even climate change. Profits from sexual exploitation are estimated to be close to $100 billion worldwide. And when San Francisco entrepreneur David Batstone discovered a human trafficking ring at a neighborhood restaurant, he began learning more about how big the problem is. His research led to a woman in northern Thailand who was rescuing street children from exploitation. Women and children were living in an empty field in northern Thailand, begging for food. Bat Stone and co-founder Mark Wexler started the nonprofit Not For Sale to raise funding to build a house for the rescued children. It then expanded to other countries where they used anti-trafficking awareness campaigns to raise money to build shelters. And then they started a beverage product, which now uses ingredients from 29 countries, with proceeds going to help expand the mission. And that mission has now become a documentary called Saving Zoe, which explores the true impact the product called Rebel is having by creating long-term sustainable financial independence for growers and, in turn, keeping them from being trafficked. Joining us to talk more about it is president of Not For Sale, David Batstone. Thank you for being with us. Tell us about the film and, of course, the product that evolved out of the mission to fight human trafficking.
Well, the film was a way of detailing the story of almost a miraculous founding and growth of this company, Rebel, from, you know, just a desire to create stable economic platforms for people in the Amazon of Peru who were being taken advantage of. So we had a shelter in Lima, Not For Sale, and we discovered that many of our kids that came into our shelter through human trafficking, we discovered that they came upstream in the Amazon River. So we said, well, let's go upstream and stop it from happening at the source. And Rebel was the solution.
And tell us about Rebel.
Rebel's an organic beverage that uses super herbs from matcha, maca, guasana leaf. Many of the herbs come from the Amazon area. And we source it, give fair wages to the native communities of that region. And then we make a great beverage and then bring 2.5% of the sale price back to those communities. So we've already devoted $1 million back to Not For Sale, to work in communities at risk.
And you've made a documentary about this, Rebel with a Cause, which is a pretty clever little name there.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's available. You know, anybody can go watch it at the Rebel website, rebel.co, C-O, rebel.co.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go and watch it. And it's a great story about how, you know, if you want to create a company that brings about better good for people and planet, you know, it would be a, you know, it'd be a matter of growing a company where there's people who believe in it and they buy the product so that you can source the ingredients, not based on what the cheapest ingredients are, but where you can have the most impact.
It's interesting because I don't think a lot of people think about the issue of climate change in connection with human trafficking, but all the work that you've done seems to indicate that there is a connection. Is that correct?
There is, because of the degradation of say farm use land, and also of the, you know, the environment itself, the resources for developing say herbs like turmeric or vanilla. You're seeing a bigger challenge, and when that challenge happens, people, farmers, and people who rely on those kind of grounded commodities, They become vulnerable, and when they're vulnerable economically, people take advantage of them, and their children get trafficked or women get trafficked. And so we see a real connection between climate change, economic degradation, and people's vulnerability.
And does this also, does your organization also address that in itself, or do you believe that the product in and of itself and the work that you're doing to raise money for this is a way to explore the link between the two? And
you know,
work
it's a great
to,
question. Yeah. It's a great question. By going into a store, you know, and we now are, you can find Rebel just about any store you shop at, Target, Whole Foods, Safeway, Kroger, you know, down to your local market. And when you walk in and buy one, you know that we give money back to those communities. So in the very operating of the company, you know, we started sourcing first in the Amazon, and now we're sourcing in 32 countries around the world. And again, we source where we can have the best effect on the environment of that region and also the people on the ground, the farmers' families. So, just in the operating of the company, we already are fulfilling the mission of Not For Sale. But then we take a percentage of the revenues of every time you buy a bottle, and we put that back into the infrastructure in those countries. So really what we want to create is a full circle where we do it the right way the first time, and then we reinvest so that we continue to expand and scale the opportunities for people who are at risk in the world.
You're also doing some political work, I understand, to work to assist trafficking victims.
You know, we feel like there's such a need for people who've survive human trafficking, they become victims of the practice, which is, you know, a large industry around the world. It rivals guns and drugs as an illicit industry, the trading of people. So, you know, we've been working on legislation through the U.S. Congress to dedicate more funds to people who are trafficking, but also more law enforcement to make it a higher risk and a costlier penalty for people who are going through situations of human trafficking.
All right, David Batstone, president of Not For Sale, a group working to fight human trafficking and bring financial independence to those who are vulnerable. British superstar DJ Fatboy Slim. Superstar DJ Fatboy Slim paid tribute to teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg by performing a remix of his hit song Right Here, Right Now using samples from Thunberg's dramatic UN speech. The 56-year-old artist played the mashup made by South African electronic artist David Scott at a show in Northeast England last week, with a video clip of the performance recently going viral on social media. The remix samples Thunberg's demands for action against climate change in her fiery speech at the United Nations last month, to be taken right here, right now, using it during each refrain of the song's title. It also includes other excerpts from the 16-year-old Swede speech. Hundreds of protesters have blocked central London streets this week as part of worldwide events organized by Extinction Rebellion, the climate movement partly inspired by the young activist. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On October 12, 1492, three Spanish ships, under the leadership of Christopher Columbus, landed on an island in what is today the Bahamas. The anniversary of that event, observed annually in the United States as Columbus Day, initiated a vast global exchange of foods, animals, plants, peoples, and diseases that transformed the world, known today as the Columbian Exchange. For that reason, 1492 is considered by many historians to be the most significant year in modern world history. World population has increased more than four times since 1492, doubling between 1650 and 1850. Although a number of contributing factors are responsible for such an enormous growth, clearly the most significant is an increased and improved food supply. The addition to the food supply of Native American food plants, such as maize, potato, tomato, peanuts, manioc, pineapple, peppers, and cocoa beans, was the most significant factor. The potato became the most important food source for the poor in Central and Northern Europe. Maize and manioc were introduced to Africa in the 16th century and replaced traditional African crops as the continent's most important staple food crops. The introduction to China of New World food crops, in particular potatoes, corn, and peanuts, resulted in a population boom between 1500 and 1650. By the 18th century, over one-third of the world's population lived in China. The Columbian Exchange was global, introducing new foods to every corner of the world. Before 1492, there were no oranges in Florida, no bananas in Ecuador, no paprika in Hungary. The exchange brought tomatoes to Italy, coffee to Colombia and Indonesia, pineapples to Hawaii, rubber trees to Africa, chili peppers to Thailand, China, and India, and chocolate to Switzerland. The landfall of three small ships on an island in the Bahamas brought about unprecedented change in the course of history. It shaped the future of humankind for centuries to come, not just because of the discovery of a new continent, but because it brought about regular contact between the Earth's hemispheres, engendering trade, allowing for an exchange of ideas, and creating connections and encounters between cultures. In 1492, the peoples of the world began to come together as a global society.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This is VOA News.